Weigand. Andreas, why don't you tell us about yourself and a very brief sort of synopsis of who you are?
First of all, good morning. Thank you for coming to our session here. What my background is, I am a data person. I spent the 80s in high energy physics, first at CERN in Europe, then at Slack at Stanford, did my PhD in physics. The 90s in data, mainly on Wall Street. I was assistant and associate professor at NYU. And then when the web came along, I became the chief scientist at Amazon.com, where, of course, is an amazing place where each day millions of people come and leave lots of traces there. So the traces from high energy physics became the traces of Wall Street, became the traces of consumers. So what we're seeing now, I teach at Stanford data mining, e-business, and also teach a couple of simple courses at Berkeley, the other school in the south of the Bay, in both the information school and at Haas on marketing and web tool. Right. So I'm a person who focuses on consumer data. I really believe that ultimately it is the end user who matters.
Whereas exactly, Oliver. Yeah. And Andreas at this point is an independent consultant, which I am also. So Andreas is a people and data person. And as Andreas says, he focuses very much on the consumer space. I focus on the internal enterprise space. And Andreas and I have had a lot of very good conversation recently about the synergies between the consumer space and the enterprise space and how they're starting to move more closely together. So there's some very rich information, which I'm looking forward to Andreas sharing with us here, of how we can use data to really help transparency and inclusiveness and treating people like people, whether they are customers, partners, employees, just people, basically. So there's some very interesting information we're going to cover today, I think.
So what we said is that I will sort of speak for a little while, making about 5 points, starting with my experience at Amazon and ending up in this world, which sort of bridges in this 2x2 table where we have external and internal, external internal, so external to internal, internal to internal, and internal to external.
Right.
So many people, ladies and gentlemen, when they think about Amazon and about data, think about people bought X, also bought Y, and think about A-B testing, and indeed, the notion that you basically don't really know anything, but you can play with everything and figure out as you go along what works better and what doesn't work so well, that is really baked into the DNA of Amazon, of Google, and other successful companies. Now, one thing I learned is, and that's the first lesson here, these A-B tests or multivariate versions of that, it's not primarily that you worry about statistical issues. The power of them is that they empower you to come up with new hypotheses, with new ideas, and that the action actually is in the first place. So if you think about back, you know, 10, 20 years ago when things weren't as agile, then it was decided through arm wrestling or however people made decisions in those days in the managerial economy. And that is very stifling. Now the idea is that you can come up with lots of actions, try them out both internally and externally, and that for me is what is the engine behind innovation.
Right. Interesting.
So it is not primarily the statistics behind A-B tests, but it's primarily the whole idea that you create alternative actions. That's how the thinking changes.
So rewinding it back to sort of the very basics, Amazon's model, which I'm obviously an Amazon customer, Amazon has a pretty detailed data history of me internally. So every time I log into Amazon, everybody knows this, obviously, it gives me all of these books that I might be interested in and videos and so on. There's a tremendous power there in the enterprise. I mean, there's a lot of issues around or a lot of progress being made around taxonomy and tagging and so on. And to me, that's the next level in the enterprise, that if you're an employee, you're actually starting to really accumulate, or the collaboration system is starting to accumulate system about you as an employee. Is there anything you can speak to around that to sort of, people have that sort of Amazon model in their mind, which everybody understands. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Right. So Oliver is making the very important point of the role of time, or more specifically, the role of history here. If you think back 10, 20 years ago, you show up at your Safeway or Sainsbury's in Oliver's case,
yep,
and they really have no idea who you are. And they could do point of sales market basket analysis by finding out those traditional examples from 15 years that beers and diapers are sold together, not because babies like beers, but because a husband on the way home picks up the baby's diapers and then says, well, I treat myself to some beer. That was a history-less approach. And interesting enough, Amazon's people bought X, also bought Y, is similarly a history-less approach. There's no history in there. If you bought X and Y within 24 hours, and you bought X and Y within 24 hours, you are the same people. Yeah. What is shifting, and that is really a deep shift, is in order to make better decisions affecting the future. And for example, what we would have there is in order to make better decisions what to buy, in order to make better decisions what's relevant for you, in order to make better decisions who to trust in some interactions, you need the past. So we are now slowly seeing that businesses are shifting towards some accountability of what some random employee said to the customer. So now history allows for accountability. That's the view into the past. The view into the future is that you now have some idea about who you can trust based on the past actions. Let me give you an example. There is, for instance, United Airlines. Are they still around?
I think they're still going, yeah.
So United
Airlines. Some people may have arrived here on United Airlines, and it's okay. Good job you're actually here.
Okay. So United is an airline, and you call them up. You make some reservation, and they tell you, well, young man, if you spend $1,500 on that ticket, then you can actually upgrade it. Okay? And then you arrive at the airport, and they say, sorry, that class of service you bought out of the 26 classes, that's not upgradable. Well, I wouldn't have bought the $1,500 ticket. I would have bought the $300 ticket, which, you know, I have now exactly seen. So basically, you have no way of having any insight, any transparency from the outside in. So it's some way a one-way mirror that you call them up, you call up the 1K line, and they actually say, if are we speaking with a person called Andreas Weigand or a person calling on behalf of Andreas Weigand. So they know exactly what I'm saying. They record it. And I have no way, this information asymmetry, to say, but that dude, he told me I would be able to upgrade. So that's very interesting. That's the notion of accountability history. What we see, I think, now is that more and more companies that treat people as people that say, well, you know, our employees have a voice. They can blog, for instance, talking about airlines. Delta put a person, sacked a person, fired a person because she was blogging about something in Delta like 4 or 5 years ago.
Right, yes.
Yeah. She also had a racy picture of herself with half of a uniform in the eye.
But that's another story, yeah.
So the notion of the asymmetry that the company knows all about you and keeps detailed data, keeps MP3s of your conversations, why don't they send us to us? They have my information, they have my email address. Why don't they say, hey, thank you for calling. If you have any questions, you know, by the way, we are sending you a highly compressed MP3 of our conversation so you can refer back to it.
Yeah.
That would be sort of removing that information asymmetry.
But that's a transparency issue, isn't it, as well? I mean,
yeah.
There's a sort of a dark side and a light side with the whole concept of being tracked. So to loop back to what you were saying about Safeway or Sainsbury's in the UK, and I actually live here, so it is Safeway. Safeway know all about how many cans of tuna I buy, but I don't have any access to that information. So there's a sort of a... There's an asynchrony, is that the word you use? There's a sort of
asymmetry.
Asymmetry, yeah. Thank you, yeah, to that. Yeah. I mean, how do you balance that? I mean, particularly in an enterprise, it's the same thing. If you're an employee, everybody knows that you're sort of being tracked and managers are writing reports about you and so on, and you're always in a state of slight tension as to kind of your status in the organization. How can you use these sort of modern technologies and data tracking schemes to sort of be more transparent?
So I think, let me ask you actually, who of you works in companies that have keystroke monitoring?
Or did you even know that they have keystroke monitoring?
Yeah, who knows that their keystrokes are monitored? It's a big business, so I guess.
You know, yeah, this is exactly. I mean, this is.
Then
this,
who of you believes that your visits, your URLs, your URL history is monitored? Okay, only 3 hands go up. Basically, anybody's URL history is monitored on the server log. So I think you can't actually do anything about it. So the point I want to make is here that what needs to shift is, because so much can be monitored, we need to not have the dichotomy between the employer and the employee, mm-hmm. that you know the employee and the employer are basically on other sides, but they should be on the same side equally well. It is not that if you call into the company to make your reservation, you're actually an enemy.
Yes.
Or if you call because something is not working on your laptop, you're the enemy. Companies should embrace and get satisfaction as a company here, which is customer service is the new marketing. Because you spend lots of money trying to get people to your site. Those people are there already. They're interested in your product. They might have your product. That is the moment when you actually can convince them that you and they are on the same side.
And we've talked before about branding at this point, haven't we? And about there's some issues about PR, which we may not go down that path today. But there's that whole issue, just to speak to what Andreas just said, that, you know, it's exactly right. Those customer transaction moments are when you really build a reputation. And in the past, we've talked about kind of brands we admire. And the one I always cite is Apple. You know, if you go into an Apple store, there's one on Market Street a few blocks away from here. It's a very clean, simple space. And when you go in, there's no bullshit. I mean, you see a laptop on the desk, and the prices are very clearly displayed, and there's somebody standing there who will talk to you about that computer. There's no ambiguity. And that, to me, that's a very good example of transparency in that way.
Yeah. So let's move a little bit onward, because we have actually lots we want to talk to you about, or we want to talk to each other about,
right.
And you know, hope that you also, if you have questions, it's not a one-way mirror here, that you will actually ask your questions. The second point I want to make is, going back to what I learned at Amazon, is as opposed to 15 years ago, now data is more important than the algorithms. So we used to live in a world which was very data sparse. Economists, who often tend to develop that personal relationship which each data point they have, still live in that world. Mm. But in the world of business, in the world of e-business particularly, no question about it, we live in a data-rich world. So what we have seen is that it's no longer that people compete by algorithms as people did 10, 12 years ago.
And cite that great example you gave me of that guy who's talking about England in the 1950s, where there was very, very little data.
Yeah, in my Stanford course last quarter, I had Colin Harrison, who used to run the IBM Research Lab in Zurich. He's now back in headquarters, talk about instrumenting the world. By the way, all my class notes are public on wikis, and if you enter Colin Harrison and Stanford, I'm sure you get to a very, very rich talk he gave. And he was born in the 50s, I think, and said when he was born, there was a handwritten passport.
Yeah.
And that was about it, the data that existed about him. Very little else. Very amazing. I mean, my first driver's license was still typed with a typewriter in the 70s. So it's quite dramatically different if you think about the data we created just today with our mobile phones, with our geolocation and so on. So
laptop, Twitter, yeah.
Yes, so it's no question about it that there is probably 10 orders of magnitude of increase of data which we're producing. I want to give you some other examples just to get your minds rolling a little bit about data. The first one is a company called 23andMe. So for $1,000, you can have your DNA sequenced, and they give you 70 fields, and I'm happy to share my DNA with anybody who wants to see it. Not that exciting. And the power there is not primarily that I know now my DNA sequence, and I know that, you know, my propensity of getting fat is not, you know, particularly bad. But the power is not 23andMe, but 23andWe. Now there are thousands and thousands of people who paid $1,000 to have their DNA sequenced. And once a week or so, we get a simple question, like, how do you perceive bitterness? It turns out that people perceive bitterness in very different ways. How do you turn red when you drink alcohol? I mean, and so on and so forth. So now there's a basis of tens of thousands of people who basically are willing to contribute to the body of knowledge which no clinical study could ever afford. So if you're interested in understanding how alcohol interacts with your system, enzymes and so on and so forth, lactose intolerance, whatever your favorite topic is, mm-hmm. you now have tens of thousands of people who just answer a simple question, noise gets filtered out. Yes, there's self-selection and so on, but ultimately your DNA has nothing to do with self-selection.
Yep.
And that is science in a very new way.
Yeah.
Pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Second point I wanted to make is, no, that's the problem, having a password in the computer. Okay. Right. An example I read in The Economist last week. That makes me think. There was a case at the East Coast about some girl being anorexic and so having an eating disorder. And the insurance paid for a month, every day, about $1,000 she needed for treatment in some hospital. And then the insurance said, okay, that's it. We're not paying anymore. And the mother of the girl said, what's going on here? Said, oh, you know, there are two reasons. There, I said, I'm not a medical guy. There's this reason and this reason, and it's clear it's a psychological problem, and that has nothing to do with it. We're not covering it anymore.
Right.
And mom said, but what do you mean psychological problem? She isn't eating, or she's vomiting, or whatever anorexia is about. And then they said, okay, you can sue us. And the mom said, okay, I'll sue you. And then they said, okay, we are now looking at every single thing that girl said on Facebook and on MySpace. That's interesting. Again, back this asymmetry, that they wouldn't say, oh, poor mother, have $1,000 for your daughter because you looked at her Facebook account and I think it's just hard for you. She should have some whatever. It's only when there's a problem that insurance companies now will say, well, based on what you said on Facebook or based on what you said in MySpace, we're not going to pay for you.
So this is, again, the challenge of living transparently. That, again, the sort of the dark force and the positive force, and that's a good example of a negative force, I guess.
Yeah. Final example here on data is geolocation, and I want to push this down to something very specific, which is geolocation for cars in fleets. I was at Burning Man last week, and it's not really clear when you read these U-Haul descriptions what you are allowed to do. It says 1995 for in-town. Nevada, Black Rock City isn't really in-town. So who knows? Maybe they have some Liberty GPS device just tacked on the bottom. And when I return the car, they say, oh, young man, you must have had some time off-road. Namely, 90% of your time was done off-road. And that means it's not the $1,000, but it is whatever, $5,000. Insurance, Progressive, started about 3 years ago and stopped about 2 months ago, the pay-as-you-drive insurance. You give them data, you allow that every single meter you drive, they're going to monitor you. And that, of course, is much more transparent, that they can see what you do. And in some ways, sounds like a good idea. Mm-hmm. Like, I teach in China every now and then, my car's in the garage here in San Francisco, nothing is happening there. Why should I pay insurance for that? But then on the other hand, if I'm driving a little bit too fast, which of course nobody ever does, and then an accident happens, then who guarantees me that the insurance company doesn't say, young man, you were driving 67 miles per hour. We are not going to pay for this. You clearly broke the law. And that's all quite tricky, that in the average we profit, but if somebody wants to show that we broke the law by driving 76 on 101 South because we were late for class or something like this, they can do it. Yeah. Final example on this, just in the geolocation, Berkeley developed something called Smart Dust, and some of the streets in San Francisco are full with Smart Dust. So on the positive side, you don't have to drive around to find a parking spot because you know exactly where cars are and where no cars are. So 30% of all traffic in the cities, at least in Los Angeles, are estimated to be people looking for parking spots. So you can really drop things down dramatically. On the other hand, in that two-hour parking spot, it knows that your car didn't move for the last 2 hours. So the police doesn't even have to go anymore because they just have a record of these are the cars who stayed there for 2 hours. And
they'll show up and give you a ticket.
Yeah.
Right.
So all these things have pros and cons. These are just very easy examples of three data sources, our DNA. Second one was insurance behavior for health insurance, sort of related to DNA, but not only. And the third one was geolocation. Many more of that. Big point number two I wanted to make after the first one, A-B testing is not about statistics, but it's about hypothesis generation.
And just explain A-B testing for anybody.
A-B testing is that you have an idea that maybe you want to have a red button or maybe you want to have a green button for buying something, and you show half of the people pre-selected, those who have, say, even customer IDs, the green button, the other half the red button, and then you measure where do you sell more. That's the simplest idea of it. But the second point was, besides this, we live in a world where it's not smart algorithms. Those are commodity right now. There are thousands of grad students at Stanford who know the algorithms. But it is coming up with collecting data, and now to the third point, coming up with incentives so people help you create those data. When I was at Xerox PARC as a postdoc in the early 90s, we found out that if we allow engineers to add their name at the bottom of some bug fix they have, Xerox makes photocopiers, not sure what they do now. But do they still make photocopiers?
I think they make all sorts of very impressive devices.
Then the engineers were much more happy to actually contribute because they got something out of it. They got their name attached to that bug fix. And the third point here, which I want to talk about now, is how do we get to those incentives?
Should I bring in the HCL comment there? So I don't know if anybody saw my talk yesterday, but there's a very interesting company called HCL, which is a big global company. And this speaks, this sort of feeds into what Andreas was just saying. So three big things that HCL are doing. Their CEO, Vineet Nayar, has basically turned the management pyramid upside down. This is a sort of the more positive side of this data transparency we're talking about. So he views the management executive team as a support group for the sort of the, what is now the top of the pyramid upside down, which is the workforce. And there's two other components to that. One is that they have an internal stock market of ideas, which is what I was, what triggered this thought in my mind. They have an internal stock market of ideas. So the idea is if you have an idea in the company, given this notion that everything is very transparent in the company, you basically can float an idea and everybody either backs it or doesn't back it. So every employee is given a notional $10,000, I think it is, to invest in ideas which they think are good ones in the company. And if you don't participate, you're actually penalized. And then if you actually, you know, let's say Andreas and I are working for HCL and we have a really good idea, we can float that idea on the internal stock market. And if it takes off and people invest in it, then you're recognized. So, you know, we have a brilliant idea for a new division. You're recognized in the company and financially rewarded, and presumably you're promoted and so on as well.
So one question is, and I invite you to listen to a podcast I did with Esther Dyson and Shoshana Zuboff. Esther is an investor, and Shoshana used to teach at Harvard Business School on digital exhibitionism. And we did this at the Fortune Brainstorm Tech Conference about a month ago. It's on Weigin.com. By the way, my name is misspelled on the program. It says W-E-I-G-E-N-D. If you misspell it, you'll probably have no luck.
We'll fix it right after this, so on the site.
We don't know who fixed it. It's not really transparency. Right. But we hear somebody must be somewhere who can fix it. But weigend.com. So what Esther and Shoshana and I discussed is, why do people do this? And Esther thinks it's because, you know, of sex. And, you know, we drilled into this a little bit, and we finally decided, you know, and I used this for a clothes retailer who was visiting me for some consulting, that, well, why do people buy clothes? They want to stay dry, they want to stay warm, and they want to get laid. And then I told a friend of mine last night who runs a company called Contagion here, which is about metrics. He says, you know, Andreas, I have to share something with you. It's not only about people buy clothes. It's a pretty general. People want to stay dry, warm, and get laid. So that idea of spreading your DNA, which leads to different male and female behavior, ultimately you could say it's about immortality, it's about leaving an impact. And that conversation is MP3, it's a very interesting hour. What we arrived at is really it's about immortality, that people feel by leaving a trace somewhere, by uttering their thoughts, this is an alternative to getting laid.
I mean, I'm still fascinated by this sort of positive and negative aspect of this, because that's clearly a very positive message. Carry on.
Yeah. So what we have seen in this consumer data revolution is in the first step, companies, Amazon being the prime example, at least the one I know best, collecting every single click you do, including the things you didn't click on. Very interesting. If you want to evaluate systems, knowing what it didn't click on is just as important as what you clicked on. Or if you think about music, the songs you skipped are just as important as the songs you selected.
Yes.
That is the first stage, implicit behavior mind. The second stage is what I just talked about, which is people voluntarily self-marketing themselves on Facebook. When I first took some pictures with people, their criteria now is, oh, that would be a good picture for me on Facebook. I have not changed my picture on Facebook a single time. But this is, oh yeah, let's, you know, one of these pictures, I think that really would look on Facebook for today, or at least for the afternoon today. So that self-marketing, that constant changing, is actually where in the first stage it was about the individual. In the second stage, it's about the relationships. So we have that people, two elements in the second stage. One, people contribute stuff. And two, people actually don't just contribute stuff about themselves, but people contribute stuff about the relationships they have with others, which is much more robust, much more stable.
Right.
Very interesting. Big shift in two ways. Not just being spied on and being inferred, he is in group number 73, thus we show him now the ads for cameras. But people voluntarily say, I'm interested in cameras. Two is, it's not just about you, but it's about the network you have. So you could say, if we move from e-business to me business, people self-prostituting themselves, to we business, which is the connection between people.
So that transparency in a business, Pete Fields was talking this morning about how there's a huge generational shift. I don't know, by Pete Fields and Wachovia. The way younger people are using Facebook and other tools like that is really rapidly changing the workforce. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, rapidly changing the workforce. And as you said very well yesterday, that person in San Mateo school district or so, he was used of using wikis.
He's speaking this afternoon here, actually. Then. Yeah.
So okay. The
15-year-old guy who's very quickly, because he'll be repeating this later, San Mateo school district, they do all their homework in Google Docs. So this is the only world he knows, basically. So as Pete Fields was actually saying this morning, a bright young kid like Daniel starts work in some brand name company, which is really impressive to him. And he starts on day one and he's in like this alien culture. I'm not going to repeat his speech, but that's a fascinating component. Carry on. I don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, IT used to be run by the gods in the IT department. Now people realize that their children at home run more interesting IT than the IT department provides them with at the workplace.
It's true, isn't it?
And yeah. So that is very interesting. It's just like I heard a talk about 15 years ago at Stanford. On the crack community in Bayview, where it's the young kids who are still juvenile delinquents if they get caught, who actually run the community, because their parents are in big trouble if they get caught. And the same is true basically how IT is moving now.
You're talking about Web 2.0 as being like a crack community.
So we had the first stage in the consumer data revolution of collecting everything, which was different from the 50s where we just had a handwritten passport.
Right.
With the second stage of people contributing stuff with a sub idea, it's not about themselves only, but also about the arcs. Now let's talk about the third stage. And that's what's really happening now.
Yeah.
And I would say, who pays whom? With the caveat that paying doesn't just mean money. Example, I have a GPS device. And I actually have a device which talks to satellite. So even in those areas where you don't have GPS, GPRS connection, something like this, I still know where I am. And it still knows my website, RSS is out. Whoever wants to listen to where I am can just go to my website. Not that interesting. But the idea here is that, and the point I want to make is, I am giving my data away. Why? Well, one thing, I always try to do new things because I think it's interesting to live that life in order to feel what it's experienced. I can't tell you exactly which company I visited 3 months ago, but just knowing the addresses on a 15-minute increment. Now, the interesting thing is, why am I still paying a monthly fee to have traffic updates? Shouldn't that company be paying me? Because my speed on 280, you can even normalize it, you know, compared to normally how other people are driving, is a super good indicator. How long it would take you, take somebody else, to get from the Castro to Stanford. So now I'm realizing I should not be paying them. Maybe they should be paying me.
Yes.
And that's what's happening in the consumer data revolution.
Exactly.
That we are no longer willing. We got used to companies spying on us and United Airlines screwing us over. Are they still around? Oh, no, I already asked. The second stage was, we're willing to give data, but we now want stuff for that.
Should we do you want to ask a question?
Yeah.
There's a movement afloat in probably a dozen startups, at least in this area, that are trying to create kind of a network of a map of people and what they know, what I know, what my interests are. Most of them are around kind of question and answer or recommendation sites. So on the web, you know, the old web is I go to Yelp to see what a restaurant's like.
Yeah.
On the next web, I ping a group of people either whom I know or a service I don't know saying, I'm in San Francisco, where should I go?
Which is a semantic
service,
web.
Yeah. Right, the service figures out, oh, this group of people knows the right answers and, you know, takes a query of that. And it's usually done by people, you know, it's done by people giving information. So I'm just curious if you'd comment on that form of kind of social mapping and information sharing.
Before you answer, just very quickly, I mean, the interesting synergy between this conference, which is Office 2.0, and the consumer space, which Andreas is equally facile with, it's the interaction between people. We were talking earlier, there's no difference really between an employee and a consumer at this point. It's like, you know, everybody is living.
Product support realm and say,
yeah.
I'm using my iPod, my iPhone, and it doesn't work with Outlook, help me. So,
right.
So the same applies to the corporate
world. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So absolutely right. The reason I was brought in here is that as a person who really lives sort of data and people and customer centricity,
yeah.
You know, in some way, why am I at Office 2? The reason is that people in the organizations are also people who also create data and who are also willing to contribute. So I think it's actually a great move that Office 2.0 wants to learn from the consumer world.
Yeah.
Which companies do you have in mind? So I just, I know a bunch of companies in that space, just to make sure we are aligned here.
Mechanical Zoo with a product called Aardvark, Mucho Bene, a French company whose name escaped.
Right, okay, good. So yes, all these companies, I mean, my favorite example is a company called Looped. L-O-O-P-T. Not sure whether any of you knows it. Yeah. Looped uses the iPhone and other phones, I think, which have GPS in them, and now really provides you with relevant information in an unprecedented way. And what I find particularly interesting is that it allows you the discovery of new things. Ultimately, searching is pretty boring. It's better than having information pushed to you. I'm not a big fan of mobile advertising. I don't want to have my phone ring in my pocket if McDonald's thinks I should get a burger with a 10% discount, that is. But I'm a big fan of discovering, think about this conference, who are the people I would like to hang out with? And that's what Looped enables you. It's not just about maintenance of your profile. It's not just about measuring the situation you're in, but it's also about discovering who you might want to meet. So that was impossible a few years ago when you actually didn't have the data about the people and you didn't have the data about the current situation. So personally, I deeply believe in this company. It's the number of competitors. I don't know the space all that well, but I know Looped, and I think that that's the way which is changing, for instance, the way we would be conducting this conference next year.
Right. I mean, the other interesting thing is it was the focus last year at this conference was on the iPhone. And again, another area which is blurring between the consumer space and the enterprise space is also mobile. So again, you have consumers walking around with an iPhone in their pocket who, you know, at some point in the day, they're a partner of a company, another point they're an employee, and another point they're a consumer. And these lines are blurring really fast.
The inside-outside actually is a great example with a mobile phone. I was consulting to a company in the Midwest, in Minnesota, called Best Buy, a couple of weeks ago, with a group called the Conversation Group. And what we had discussion there was, how can we empower employees within like 140,000 people in the companies to actually debug what they have in the data and to contribute information?
Yeah.
And then the next question was, how can we, with a web service like architecture, similar to Amazon Web Services, actually allow them to write cool apps?
Yeah.
And the next question was, why limit it to the 140,000 people there? There are 400,000 people who write Facebook apps. I haven't seen a single one which I find interesting, but still, there are 400,000 people trying to, you know, change the way the world works by allowing people to buy and sell each other and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So now, that's 400,000. If you take the probably 40 million people who went to Best Buy this year already, I don't know the exact number, don't quote me on this, I'm just a physicist who does out of 10. Let's say the 10 million people, that's a conservative estimate. Then you suddenly have an enormous number of people who from the outside helping the inside.
Yes.
And those are very, very, very new ways with your mobile phone, when you are there, of helping yourself by annotating something and helping the company.
Mm-hmm.
So my perspective, and that's sort of really what is really new here, is it is not that companies try to push their stuff to people in even smarter ways. It is that we have data. So the solution to the problems which we have right now, information overload, is that we allow people to fix data, to create metadata with things, data about the data. For instance, I don't think that is quite right. Or in Get Satisfaction's example, yes, I have that problem too. And suddenly, we are able to come up with very simple relevance algorithms, which is not very complicated anymore, but allow to just aggregate what people say and show people the stuff they're interested in.
Yeah, exactly. So contextual, feeding the information that you harvesting the information that you know people want and then giving it to them in the Amazon model.
Yeah. So data strategies, which was in part of our title here, data strategies means to figure out how do you get people to contribute. It means doing it in a transparent way, not screwing them over. Mm-hmm. And it means figuring out how you create qualitatively new services, not just quantitatively, like qualitatively new services, which are only enabled by people sharing voluntarily data, helping you out in the organization. I think that's what bridges it back to what Office 2.0 is about.
Perfect, yes, okay. Got 5 minutes.
Oh, thanks. I had one question. So it's clear to me when I'm on Amazon and I'm contributing data that my data and my behavior is owned by Amazon. They can do with it what they will, right? They can present me new choices. But in how do you handle situations where multiple people claim ownership of a single data point? So in the enterprise space, it's I'm working on something with three other people. All four of us claim ownership of this data point, but also my company owns that data. So even if I leave the company, I may not be able to use that data later on.
So I admire Jeff Bezos. Jeff is an absolutely clean person, highest integrity you can imagine. And when you ask him, friends, about the data ownership, he is a big proponent of allowing people to take out whatever they want to take out. So I don't know whether web services makes it easy, but in principle, it should be easy to just simply take out your entire purchase history. The idea, for instance, I remember that discussion very vividly with him, that Amazon is not primarily about selling you books. It's about supporting your decision-making process. So it probably has happened to a number of us that we thought about buying a book because it looked so kind of interesting, and then Amazon said, just to let you know, you already bought that book in 1997. Wow. So they could have just, you know, sold us another book, or they can remind us that we bought it and say, yes, I know I bought it, and I want to buy it for a friend as a present because I liked it so much when I bought it 11 years ago. So that's very interesting, how that shift that you want to actually support the customer. And from that perspective, the data, of course, are as much yours as they're Amazon's. Amazon wants to, well, ultimately, build better algorithms, build better recommendations, and that's why our books get scanned in, so you can find stuff you couldn't find beforehand and stuff like that.
One other point as well is transparency. By definition, information is free. You know, so if you're running a large enterprise and you've made serious decisions that information is going to flow freely, the information isn't really owned by anybody. So you know, until recently I was at Sony PlayStation, which is a large global company, and talking about Facebook actually, a lot of people at PlayStation are all on Facebook, and there's a very sophisticated social network outside PlayStation talking about PlayStation issues. So that's actually quite an interesting dynamic, that arguably there is a stronger social network outside Sony PlayStation of its employees than inside. And there's a very interesting dynamic around data and depth of knowledge there. So who actually owns that information is kind of very much up in the air. And you can make very clumsy management decisions around that, which you'll, yeah.
Let me give you actually an example which I think is quite instructive. Facebook is, in my eyes, super primitive. Yeah. It's a binary company. Either Oliver and I are friends or we're not friends. And it doesn't even surface whether I invited you or whether you invited me. That's different. Okay, so I mean, how can somebody, the world is not a binary place. So let's push this a little bit further. Facebook says, oh, of course, we respect the privacy of the users. Okay, but I mean, come up with some granularity here. Here's an example. When I visit Oliver's page, Oliver clearly states, "Dear visitor, I am recording every click you're doing on my page." So the question is, will I still click through his 755 pictures? Or will I say, well, in that case, you know, I'll just, you know, look at a couple of them. Or I state, hey, I'm not recording anything. I just have one bit, which is, you were here. I do know that. But be free, download everything I have, check out all my friends, whatever you want to do. I don't want to have that level of granularity.
Yeah.
So that negotiation of privacy is, I think, the next step after the question about who owns the data. And they tried, Facebook, they tried, you know, a couple of things like doing thumbs up and thumbs down on ads. It's just that nobody clicks.
It's AOL again, isn't it, really? It's another AOL walled garden, Facebook, which is nothing to do with what we're saying.
Yeah. And so I think if you think about who owns the data, which is a very good question, I want to really go one step further upstream. What do you know as you collect the data or as you produce the data, as you generate the data? The woman, the anorexic girl, and her mom, did she know that when she was writing something on Facebook, eventually it will lead to the insurance company trying to deny her the benefits?
Probably not.
Yeah. So ownership of data is one thing, access to data is another thing. A data strategy for me has all of that. It has the incentives to create, and what we need to do is we need to sort of talk about this, we need to make people aware about the data, the advantage they have, clearly advantage they have. For instance, typically, actually, I have all my itinerary online. So if you go to viking.com/itinerary, it tells you exactly what flight I'm on, where I'm sitting, and typically the hours or 2 hours before international flight, journalists call because they know the guy can't be anywhere but sitting in some lounge eating peanuts, you know, United Airlines, and, you know, he's happy to talk to us about anything in this moment.
But pitching this back.
Oh, peanuts, that was before, yes. Now it's just drinking water. Right?
Free pitch for Andreas. Basically, companies desperately need data strategies to control, you know, the question you just asked. I mean, all this information is out there, and you need to have strategies and tactics around how you're going to use this information and model it and shape it for the good, preferably.
For the good, and I think the beautiful thing is that people, companies, individuals, employees will be called out if they lie.
Yes.
And you all know these examples where companies had blogs, and, you know, Walmart paying these journalists.
Or PR, written blogs, that kind of thing, yeah.
And it turns out, and I just want to give one example, that if you actually honestly say, we have 7 seats left in this for this price, or 2 seats left for this price.
On an airplane. Yeah.
Or in a concert.
Yes.
Or, you know, wherever. I mean, just where there's a limited supply, then it's a good thing, because people actually say, well, that's the case, and I trust them, as opposed to some stupid marketing trick. Buy now, tomorrow it will be $5 cheaper anyways.
Right.
Or the other way around, it will go up tomorrow, something like that. If you actually are honest about this, it's a good thing for everybody. And closing the loop here about the data and the data strategy, I wonder, for instance, why isn't there a secondary market for airline tickets? Because, you know, it doesn't really matter who sits in that seat.
Right.
So why don't we just assign some long key to somebody, some cryptography, you know, everything is possible, and then we allow them to basically say, hey, my metadata is, I don't care whether I fly today or tomorrow. So if you give me $50, I'll fly tomorrow. Whereas for us here who needed to be here, well, we need to be here. So my metadata is, you need to pay me a lot of money in order to actually not make the flight which I need to make in order to be here at the conference.
Right.
So all of that's about data generation, information generation, data strategy, what should they reveal, and that really needs to be thought through very deeply. I'm going to be at HP Hewlett Packard on Tuesday, and we'll discuss with like 15 marketing people precisely those questions. What's happening there, what should they open up, and what are the crown jewels which they should actually protect?
Interesting. And any other questions?
Small and medium businesses,
mm-hmm.
is there a way for them to be able to access the technology that Amazon has that says people who buy X also buy Y?
Okay, the technology and the data are two different worlds. The technology is commodity. There's a company I was advisor at called Cleverset, which bought by ATG earlier this year, which has a super, no interest anymore, by the way, in the company, just to be clear, which has, in my opinion, the best technology for recommend assistance. What's hard is to get to the data. Yeah. So Amazon was very smart in the late 90s of helping out AOL with product recommendations. But who was helping out whom there? AOL was populating Amazon's product matrix by the co-clicking behavior, because there were more people at AOL at that stage than at Amazon. So this beautiful example of data strategy that ultimately is not about the algorithms. Sun, I believe, Sun Microsystems has open source recommender systems. They come a dime a dozen. There's just a few tricks, like in, let's say, search, same thing, you know, normalization issues. But ultimately, it is you thinking through very deeply and very clearly and very crisply what it is that you need to do so your data gets collected in the right way and you enable both internal employees and external customers to help you by generating data, which ultimately are good for them, but in the second place, help the company.
Yeah, and in some ways, this loops into what I was talking about yesterday, of people, yes, processes, technology, and scaling. The technologies are a commodity, open source, whatever.
We would have time for one final question, if we have any.
We good? Thank you very much.
And thank you, Oliver.
Thank you. Yeah, well done, mate. That's good.